Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Before you've all become too absorbed, you and your guests might like a cup of tea.
Oh, you shouldn't.
You know, Professor, you didn't tell me the truth about yourself and these other gentlemen. Why, you're not the least bit like amateurs. You really must be professionals. You're every bit as good.
Not quite, though we are rather proud of Mr. Harvey's tab.
And that pizzicato passage, Mr. Lawson, quite delightful. May I ask you where you studied?
Well, I didn't really study any place, lady. I just picked it up.
Hi, I'm Mike.
And I'm Dan.
Welcome back to 15-Minute Film Fanatics. This week, I picked the movie. Dan, what are we doing?
The Lady Killers.
The Lady Killers, British black comedy from 1955, directed by Alexander McKendrick and starring the inimitable Alec Guinness.
And Alexander McKendrick, I just want to say, is a friend of the pod, because do you know what Alexander McKendrick also directed?
No.
Off the top of your head, he directed a movie that not only do we love, but we actually did an episode on way back in the day. And it makes no sense.
Get out of here.
He also directed Sweet Smell of Success.
No, he did not.
Yes, he did. The same guy is responsible for Sweet Smell of Success and The Lady Killers. How about that?
You already won the pod for this time, but you got to give me your overall take since it was my pick. So why don't you go?
So I've seen the movie before, but I hadn't seen it maybe in, I don't know, 20 years. All I vaguely remembered was that it was a dark comedy. I remember that it was about a bunch of, armed robbery guys who have to somehow, they get cowed by this little lady. Watching it again, here's a couple things I thought of. First, it's a caper movie that has a great variation. Like, as you know, in every caper movie, they set the caper, but then what has to happen?
Something has to go wrong.
And what's hilarious is that what goes wrong is that there's a witness, very normal thing, but it turns out the witness is your grandmother. So that's what's great about this. But the really great thing about it is that it reminded me very much of a John Cheever story called Reunion from 1962. You know this story?
I do.
Yeah. So it's about a guy who, like, the last time I saw my father, they go to a bunch of different restaurants, and the guy's father is a big blowhard, and he's the center of attention. And you understand why this guy never sees his father. The great thing about that story is it does what a novel would do in ordinary hands in like a page and a half. You get their whole relationship. You get why he didn't talk to his father. You get both of their characters perfectly. It's like the absolute, I can't think of a better example of economy of language than that story, right?
It's wonderful.
So this is like that, I thought, that this movie is so compact. It's maybe 89 minutes long. It's so funny. It does so much where it keeps shifting genres, where you're in a comedy, then it's a dark comedy. You get great performances. You get a totally entertaining caper thing. You get all the surprise deaths as they go on at the end. And it's over and she's back with her new umbrella in 89 minutes. It's just like Reunion.
Yeah, my notes said that this is like if Roald Dahl wrote Ocean's 11. And that's how I feel about this movie, including young Peter Sellers, who would be in this movie, who is absolutely fantastic, but has what for Peter Sellers is an understated performance.
Yeah, it's that's so great. It is like if Roald Dahl wrote Ocean's 11. You know, all those Ealing Studios movies that I'm sure you love, like Kind Hearts and Coronets and The Lavender Hill Mob and The Man in the White Suit, like they're all done, and if this is another example, with like the perfect touch.
What they're out to do is create an amusement. It's a 90-minute amusement, but what's beautiful about it is that requires such economy of skill. It's almost, it's like Mozart. It's somehow dense with information, but it's light and fluffy and airy. It's like the perfect dessert. That doesn't mean you have to like it, but that means that there's an art to it. And definitely anything with weird Alec Guinness is on the right track.
Well, he's playing Alistair Sim, who he thought, you know, we should have had the part. It's perfect. But you know who he reminded me of? And I don't know why this is. You'll explain it. How good would he have been in that same costume with the same face if they made another movie of David Copperfield and he was Uriah Heep?
Yeah, he is able to enter the Dickensian mode somehow, which is that his character takes himself seriously. Alec Guinness takes his art seriously. But there's something seriously unserious about what's going on. It's almost like a cartoon come to life, and the stakes are higher, but it always maintains its aura of harmlessness. None of the deaths in this movie take you out of the movie even for a second. That's not how they work, and that's not how they operate. They might as well be Wile E. Coyote blowing himself up with his rocket skates,
yeah,
which is what's brilliant about so much of the violence here. Everything done by this studio is beautiful, but Alec Guinness particularly is able to embody that kind of character, which is not what he's known for by American audiences. But I think American audiences know him only in his larger, more dramatic roles like Bridge Over the River Kwai, or, you know, playing Obi-Wan Kenobi or something. But I have a question. Are those fake teeth?
I don't know. And I couldn't figure it out. And that's a testament to the movie.
That's not a fake question for the pod.
No.
I spent a lot of time trying to figure out if those are fake teeth or he was doing something with his lip.
Yeah, I don't know. And it's funny what you said about Alec Guinness, because this is such a British film, isn't it? I mean, the perfect light touch, because it's perfect, because in this movie, like, you know, decorum and like saying the right thing and following the rules of social life is as much of a force as the law, if not even more so.
I don't know if you're into this, but it's kind of like, it's like Gilbert and Sullivan, but with no music.
Yeah,
except
totally.
it does have music, and yeah. It's literally drawing room comedy, but it's such brilliant, updated drawing room comedy, but it's also somehow so rooted in its own time and feel. She's got to have the last house that's surrounded by that drab 1950s construction, post-war construction, because everything was blown up.
You know what?
But it has to loom over the house in a certain way.
Yeah, like Mr. Fredrickson and Up. But, you know, it is very much a Gilbert and Sullivan. You know why? Because you don't laugh the whole movie. And there's some big laughs. Like when the case opens up and all the money falls out, that's a great laugh, right? That's a big laugh. But you don't really laugh the whole movie, but you smile the whole movie. And there's some movies where you laugh the whole way through, but this one you have a smile on your face, just like Gilbert and Sullivan.
There's something about really big laughs in movie. We all love to laugh, and they're fantastic. But there is something that kind of slows down the timing of the movie. You know, every time you laugh, you drag. So you to design something to smile is something that feels shorter than its 90 minutes and never drags. And this definitely doesn't.
Welcome back. In part two, we always talk about our favorite moment. Mike, what's yours?
This is a moment like the one that we were just talking about, where it's not a huge laugh, but it's a smile gag, and it goes on for just the right amount of time, which is when everybody's trying to squeeze themselves into the phone booth at the same time, which of course it's such a sight gag and it's such a stage thing. It really doesn't belong in any movie for whatever reason, because it works if four or five grown men are going to do that in front of you in the physical space that you're in. That's really funny. But for them to insist upon it, and I don't know if this was a play or what the deal with it was, or what source material it was adapted from. I didn't bother to look it up.
It became a play eventually.
Right. So that strikes me as the kind of thing that would go over really well on the stage, but it goes over beautifully in this movie. And there's nothing that's super funny about it, except that you see what's going to happen before it happens, and then it's one, and then it's two, and then it's three, and then it's all four of them, because they're so eager to see what's happening with the money. And of course, the gag is that they get away with the crime, but then nobody can get the loot, which is so brilliant, because you think, right, from a timing perspective, that it's too early in the movie for the crime to have happened. But then the movie tells you what it's really going to be about. What's your moment?
So my moment is when all the other the gaggle of old ladies come over, and Mrs. Wilberforce finds out what the truth is, and she looks at them and says, you know, she expresses how disappointed she is. She's not angry. She's disappointed. And she says, simply try for 1 hour to behave like gentlemen. Now, let's unpack that. You know, Mrs. Wilberforce, of course, is named after William Wilberforce, right? The 19th century MP who was instrumental in abolishing the slave trade. I mean, that name contains a moral authority, and she is the moral authority of this universe, and that's why the crooks all obey her. And it's so funny because it reminds you of something that's very, very common to a lot of people's lives, is that how you act when you're a little kid. You act one way, you act a different way when your parents are around, but when your grandma comes over, you had better have everything polished. You had better make sure everything's fine. And I know this from my own kids, right? So they act one way when you're home, but then if grandma's coming over, you kind of change the way you behave, because there's something about older people, especially little sweet old ladies, are powerful in inverse proportion to their physical stature, their tone of voice, all of those things. And that's why they all obey her. And that's why none of them want to kill her.
So when the movie starts, you care about Mrs. Wilberforce, and what you care is that these creepy guys are coming into the apartment. By the middle of the movie, you want the creepy guys to get their money. And so she's got to go from the hero somehow to the antagonist.
To an impediment.
But back to the hero. And she's got to do that in a very, it's a very cartoonish way. But what I mean is, it's got the same structure as Bugs Bunny, where Bugs Bunny is conversely the thing that is being chased, but also the thing that is antagonizing the force that wants to chase him. And that's actually very complicated, but this movie gets away with it seamlessly, so you don't even realize that it's happening.
And to build upon what you just said about Warner Brothers cartoons, Mrs. Wilberforce is not the old lady who takes care of Tweety Bird. Right now, that lady in the cartoons is a dimwit. She's just a feather brain, so to speak, running around the house. Mrs. Wilberforce is not. And that's why when she says, you know, I'm shocked and appalled when she finds out. She doesn't like run to call the police, like, because that's worse. It's like when your mother says, I'm just very disappointed in you. Well, you'd much rather have her yell at you, right?
And they try to convince her that she's an accessory.
Yes, right. And that doesn't work at all. So she's innocent in some ways, like for the fact that, like, I love that they have to pretend that they're musicians playing chamber music, right? Because an old lady will eat that up. They could, Alec Guinness, they could have pretended that they were all like authors, and they have to be quiet in their thinking. But the idea that, oh, they're musicians. And remember what Alec Guinness calls himself? He's a professor, right? So they push all the right buttons to get an old lady to be thrilled to live there. But of course, when she finds out they're not those things, she's not naive enough to think that, what should I do now? I mean, she's disappointed in them, because not even because they're robbers, but because they lied to her.
She's oblivious without being obtuse.
Yeah, that's exactly what she is.
Welcome back. So in part three, of course, we always talk about the title or the ending or the key takeaways. Dan, did you have something on the title?
Yeah. Well, first of all, the title has the same light touch as the rest of it does. It's a great, great title. I kept thinking that Oscar Wilde would have really liked this movie, because when you watch The Importance of Being Earnest, there's not a lot of laughs that slow everything down, but it's all like, you know what that's like. So it's all these things that make you grin the whole time. And I think Oscar Wilde is really good at that. I think he would have loved this. I think the joke about the title is that if you didn't know any better, you'd think you were going to watch like Swingers, or something. It would be about a bunch of young bachelors who are going to go out on the night scene and try to, like, you know, and then one of them finds true love in spite of himself. But I think the joke here is that, is that they are the lady killers literally, right? Instead of figuratively. I think the ending is also great when she goes back to the police station, but they all dismiss her as a kook, right? And we get that poetic justice because, you know, Alec Guinness gets conked on the head and he falls over. Like you said before, no one's like, oh no, dear Alec Guinness. I mean, it's just a cartoon like all these other deaths in here. But of course, she gets to buy that new umbrella. Everything is right with the world. She's going to get the money. So it's like the universe comes down on the old lady's side.
And everything is kind of going her way. I think that's part of the irony of the title is that, again, when you're first introduced to the movie, you're set up to think that the movie is going to be about these five guys that take advantage of this little old lady. And I think the reason that she has birds, other than that, it's really funny, is so that you can see them cramped into the, that little back room and realize that she not has birds, she has guys. And she writes, because she feeds them and she calls them pet names and they make music that she likes and they can't escape and there's nowhere that they can go. And I think that's how they do, I guess what I want to say is a transfer of sympathy. You have to do a transfer of sympathy very delicately onto the guys, but then she has to receive it back without you ever realizing that it had left her at all. And that's what's so beautiful about this movie.
And there's a great moment where, of course, when the title becomes literal, when they all start drawing, when they all start picking the short match, and then suddenly, but it's great. The first time you see it, like 5 minutes before, you think to yourself, oh my God, they're gonna try to kill her. They're gonna have to kill Mrs. Wilberforce. And you're like, is this movie really going there? And they do. And of course, the toughest guy is like, you're not killing Mrs. Lopsided, because he's of course like the big dumb, you know, most lovable guy. He wants to take care of her. But certainly, yeah, your sympathies get thrown around a lot, and that's what makes it so much fun.
Yeah, and it's so beautiful to see a Lenny where almost nothing bad happens to Lenny until the very end. He's a stock character. But they're all stock characters,
right?
Which is what's great about them. I mean, you could replace this Mrs. Wilberforce for Bugs Bunny, and as long as he ended it, you know, in a nightie with his you know, with a little cap on or something, everything would be exactly as it was supposed to be.
Thanks for listening, everybody. We hope you enjoyed our conversation about The Lady Killers, the 1955 version. Let us know what we should watch next. Follow us on X at 15minfilm. Also follow us where, Mike?
Letterboxd.
Follow us on Letterboxd. Give us requests. We take requests, and we'll see you next time.